From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is the dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Hello, Denise. You read a lot, Pope.
Hi, Dan. I do read a lot. I like to read. Reading is fun. Plus, I was an English major and an English teacher.
You know, I used to like to read.
Yeah?
Yeah, I just watch TV now.
Okay. Okay. Not great for the kids out there listening. But
sorry. I watch TV after I've done my homework.
Yeah. Okay. So, Dan, I have a note that I should ask you a question that is about comprehending what you read.
Yeah,
so when you used to read, how did you know if you were comprehending it or not?
Right. So I'd never read. So my story is actually about my dad.
Okay.
My dad, very smart, scholarly, educated man, and he loved to read mystery novels. And so he's reading this mystery novels, and he's like on chapter 16. He just can't put it together. You know, and he's read 150 pages. Suddenly he realizes they're short stories.
Oh, no!
So he was sort of comprehending at one level, but he was pushing for a level of comprehension beyond.
There are some short story collections that do have running themes, so it's not actually his fault.
Yes,
for
James
thinking
Joyce.
That. Yes.
See, I am red.
Whew.
Yeah.
That's a tough one, too. Dubliners?
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
Yeah. Well, I know why the snow falls at the end.
Okay, well, that's all.
Sorry, too obscure to see. Don't ask me.
So here's
another example, though,
okay,
about me reading. So I decided I needed to read this book about time. I've always been fascinated about time. And this was a book about the introduction of clocks into medieval Europe and how time, now there was like formal time, completely changed the society. And I'm reading this in French, and I'm really pleased. And I'm on like page 52, and there's this word I don't know. And I'm trying to figure it out by context. I can't figure it out. So I look it up. And once I saw it, I realized I must not have understood anything else that I had read in French because this word could not be there.
First of all, the fact that you would even read a book in French is pretty impressive.
No, not if you didn't comprehend any of you thought.
But like on that topic and everything, that's pretty, yeah, erudite.
Liberal arts. Go liberal arts.
Small liberal arts education. Yeah. Good.
So how about you? Do you know when you're comprehending something or not?
I will, if I'm not understanding, even if it's fiction, even if it's for pleasure, if I kind of read a paragraph and I go, wait, that's not what I was thinking was going on, I'll go back. Like I'm that sort of anal, I guess. But I want to know, I don't want to miss what is going on. And even in books like the Harry Potter books, you know, there's elaborate, you probably haven't read, have you read the Harry Potter books?
TV.
Okay. Are you seeing the movies?
Yeah.
Okay. The books are better, I will say.
Of course.
But you know, there's so many characters, you want to keep everything straight. And when you get to that chapter, you get to that paragraph and you're like, wait a minute. And then I go back and kind of rejig. So I'm that kind of person.
Yeah. So we're different.
Yeah.
You're trying to read, comprehend kind of the story and get the narrative. I'm sort of reading to try and find out what's beneath it all that's not in the text itself.
Are you accusing me of not being deep? Wait, this is what English majors do, Dan. We go subtext for sure.
Okay.
Uh-oh, I think we better introduce our guest
for blushing.
This one.
I'm blushing. So it is, all things reading,
literate, all things
comprehension.
Reading.
We have with us Rebecca Silverman. So we're very fortunate. She's a professor in the Graduate School of Education, and she is the expert in literacy and reading development. And kids pre-K through elementary school, so you and I may be safe from her analysis. So welcome, Rebecca. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I have a question that I'm dying to ask.
Okay,
is that okay? Can I start us off?
Go.
There's this thing over the years called reading wars. And I thought that reading wars were done. I thought the wars were over, and apparently they're not. So can you tell people what reading wars are and why they're still going and how I could be so out of it?
Right. So as I understand it, you teach a class where like each week is a different war. So there's sort of battles.
There's a bunch of battles.
They're reading battles.
Gosh, but I thought they were done. So fill us in.
Yeah, so you would think something like reading that's been studied for a very long time, we would have the answers, right? Turns out, not quite. At least there's a lot of disagreement about it. So the reading wars started many, many years ago with sort of two camps. One that was focused on teaching kids how to read specific words. So they would break apart words into small parts, build them back together. And that really took a systematic, very explicit teacher-centered approach to instruction. And then there was sort of another camp of researchers who said, actually, you know, what we really need to do is we need to immerse kids in lots of language, lots of print, lots of reading experiences so that they can build their literacy over time. And turns out that these wars over time, one would be more dominant, another would be more dominant. Curricula were devised around them, teaching strategies were devised around them. And it was kind of this constant back and forth, swinging of the pendulum. Around the 1990s into 2000, the National Reading Panel report came out, and we thought that that had sort of settled the debate. But it turns out people use this term balanced literacy to sort of say, we're going to do both. We're going to do...
How could it not be?
Well, wait, let's break it down so people really understand. So if we're talking about like cat, like the word cat, you would go cat, right? Like cat, and that's one way to teach it.
No, what?
Is that right?
Right, but I need to be able to do that. Now tell me about the other way, and I'll point out I need to be able to do that
too. And so the other way is there's, you know, you label like the cat's bowl, you know, cat. Bowl for cat or something like that, so that's like it's in the environment and it's there's context clues. Are we flailing on this?
No, you've got it. So okay. So right, part of it is there's a bit of a difference in terms of are we talking about learning to read words, and so there is a debate about learning to read words themselves. And one debate is that you break them up into little parts and then you put them back together. Another one is that you look at the whole word and memorize it, kind of memorize lots of different words and get fluent on it, thinking that it takes too long for us to look at all the little parts and words to actually be able to do that over and over again. And that's the debate. So,
I'm sorry.
You are not getting this.
No, I'm too simplistic.
Okay.
If I see a word I've never seen, I need to be able to have word attack strategies. On the other hand, if it's a word I see all the time, memory is always faster. So, don't I want both?
Yes, you do. Right. So
who's battling? Who are these people that are battling?
This is so obvious. We've solved it right here on the show.
Are these people are trying to make money off of this? Why?
Yeah, in part. I mean, curricula are developed and they're, you know, touted as research-based and they're sold mass market, and that is part of it.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are speaking with Rebecca Silverman, who is a literacy expert, or an expert on how to teach reading, talking about the reading wars, which are still going on.
So give us one. Give us one of the debates, and then Denise and I will take opposite sides.
Okay, so we talked a little bit about the decoding debate. Let's move over to the vocabulary debate a little bit. It's a very similar debate, and these debates, they kind of have a similar theme. But there's one camp that says we should teach kids words. We should tell them what they mean, show them pictures about it, act them out, read books using those words. And there's another camp that says there's just too many words to teach kids. We should not be spending our time teaching words explicitly. It just takes too much time. So they say, again, we should immerse kids in lots of language, lots of words, and they'll pick them up. What do you think?
Which side would you like?
Okay, well, let me just say one thing
about... Do you want to take random exposure or over-hyper-focused training?
Okay, wait. I want to say two things that will inform the debate.
Okay.
Or you'll at least inform what I'm going to say about the debate. One is my kids' preschool had everything labeled. So like snack cabinet and chair and desk and blocks. And I mean, there were words all over the place, but they didn't like teach them the separate words and give them a quiz. Okay, so that's one. So know that about my environmental thinking. Okay. The other thing is when I was teaching English, now granted this was at high school, I was required to give vocabulary quizzes. And it was ridiculous because they were not connected to anything the kids were doing, and it was just literally teaching this random set of words, and there was cheating going on in my classroom. They would just copy, and I knew that that was just bogus, so I stopped giving them, and it was kind of a radical move on my part. And instead, I would pull words from like To Kill a Mockingbird or whatever I was teaching. So I could still say I was giving vocabulary quizzes, but at least they had something to do with the context. Okay, so those are the two things. So which side do you think I'm going to take?
I'm sort of losing the sides, but I think the side you're going to take is the one where kids should learn words in the context of use.
That's what I would say.
So I'm going to take the side where they should mindlessly memorize words like math facts.
Good luck with that, buddy.
I'll give it a shot. So, you know, I took, sorry, initial volley. I took SAT prep in power reading in, I guess, 11th grade. It was a course. Everybody loved the course. You know, you would read things, and as you got better, you would have less time to read it, and then you'd answer questions. But there's also vocabulary, and there were like, you know, I have thousands of words, and I learned them.
But you memorized them.
Yeah, and then eventually some, you know, and then I'd absolutely abuse it in conversation because I didn't quite understand the nuance, you know, but then I would learn the nuance. And so I got a jump start by having a really large, somewhat ineffective vocabulary that then became effective. I enjoyed it. I knew when I was right and when I was wrong. My SAT scores went up. I know words you don't know.
You are the only one I know who could say, I enjoyed SAT prep. Thank you, Dan Schwartz.
No, I don't think that's true.
you think there's other people like you who enjoy SAT prep?
Yeah, if they're not worried about how they do in the SAT. Learning is fun.
Okay,
these.
Rebecca, debate.
I didn't hear you.
Oh, I feel like I can rest my case. I feel like we already said my kids' preschool is all words all the time in context, and I pull words from context for my English students. I feel like the only way learning that life is too short to learn a list of 1,000 rando words.
If the kid was learning lots of different types of butterflies, you'd say, oh, isn't that sweet that this child is developing a passion around butterflies and knows all these words?
If they all goes together. See, that's the thing. The SAT words are all disparate.
Meaning is overrated.
Rebecca.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Tell us as an expert.
Yeah, I mean, as most of these things turns out both.
Who knew?
Yes and, right?
Yes and.
No, but I mean, we need, I think there is a role to play for this explicit instruction, and we kind of provide a foundation for kids of words that they can know and that they can use as sort of like glue or Velcro to build other words onto. And then you put them in context, you do it in a thematic approach where they're hearing lots of other related words so that they have other things to build their semantic networks. So it's important to try to do both as a teacher. But yeah, these wars continue.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking reading wars with Rebecca Silverman and the right way to teach reading.
Sometimes things get exaggerated in academics, and you get too strident about things. So, like, there's a theory of constructivism that people need to build their knowledge. I think this feeds into the kind of classroom you wanted for your child. Mm-hmm. And so I've watched teachers, and there's this kid that's struggling and really working to put it together. And I go up to the teacher and I say, you know, now's a good time to just tell them the answer. And the teacher's response was, I didn't think I was allowed to tell.
Mm.
So this kind of sort of weird over-exaggeration of a point of view, when humans are a little too complex for one rule applies in all situations.
So how does this fit with reading? Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think teachers often end up taking a certain perspective and going with that perspective and not necessarily learning how to integrate multiple perspectives. So in that case, a teacher might pick up this idea that they're just supposed to immerse kids in words and telling them a word is inappropriate when, you know, that's not really the case.
So if I was a parent of a young kid who's not reading yet and all the other kids seem to be reading, What do I do? Can you force a kid to read before they're ready? Because I have parents who will basically say, like, I'm going to just get this kid to read. Is that doable?
Not really.
I had this image of me trying to force my dog to read.
Right. Well, no, but there's this thing, because there's also that philosophy of they'll read when they're ready and you can't push it And, but it's got to be somewhere in between, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So again, it's providing kids with the exposure. So having them enjoy reading is kind of the first important part, seeing that there's a function for reading and a reason to read. So providing that environment that kids are reading with their parents or listening to books, that's going to be kind of the entree. But then providing kids with a little bit of information to help break that code, you know, this is where you start to read a book. This is how you break through a word. That can give kids the tools that they need to start breaking it down. But if you do that kind of subtly over time, kids will start to pick it up, and then you'll notice when they become very interested in trying to figure out words, and that's when you come in with a little bit more explicit instruction.
So you'll take the cue from them based on their interest, and if they're really fighting you, like, no, Mom, you read it. Please don't make me read it. Which my kids might still be doing, like, until, I mean, right? It's much more fun to have someone read it to you. It's much harder to, like, try and do the decoding. But if you're noticing a curiosity, you can go with it.
Yeah, and when kids start to wonder about words and they start to try to break them apart, and then they start to get a couple of them, there's a real joy and excitement and motivation that kids will take on. So you'll see that they're ready.
A little bit of success will go
a long way, yes.
Nice, nice, nice.
So sorry, I know the practical is very helpful here. I'm still, these wars fascinate me. So we started by talking about comprehension. Is there a war over what's comprehension?
Yeah, I mean, it's a similar kind of war. So some people break comprehension down into strategies. We're going to teach strategies to kids. We're going to use what we know about what good readers do and teach kids to do that. So things like previewing a text, predicting what's going to happen, asking questions about the text, summarizing. Those are what good readers do, so we're going to teach kids to do that. Other people say that that's really very stilted, and trying to teach people these strategies is not going to get them very far, and that what we need to do is, again, immerse them in literature that they're very motivated to read, they're interested in reading, and that's going to get them to the point where they can comprehend.
So I was told as a mom, when I was reading aloud to my kids, I was told I should say, before I turn the page, what do you think is going to happen next? Like, building in those strategies.
You're not allowed to do that, because that's both. Right? That's both in a context of understanding, a rich content, and a strategy.
And I say, what do you think is going to happen next? Or actually, as an English teacher, I did this with my high school kids all the time. We would read the first page of the new novel, and I'd have them think about what it might be. Like, what is the story? What would the story? What do you think is going to follow this page? Just to get
interest. On the first page?
Yeah, like To Kill a Mockingbird, there's a Romeo and Juliet, there's a lot, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is a place where some of these tools that we provide to teachers actually gets taken to the extreme. So I think it's helpful to get kids to sort of activate their background knowledge about a book and get them ready to read. But some teachers spend 15 minutes previewing a text before the kids ever start reading it. And that's where you start to wonder, is this actually supporting reading acquisition? Maybe we've gone too far.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We will have more about all things reading and the reading wars with Rebecca Silverman next on SiriusXM Insight 121.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking today with Professor Rebecca Silverman, an expert in literacy and teaching literacy, talking about the reading wars and how hard it is to know the right way to do this.
So I came up with a hypothesis, and it's even relevant to our opening gambit on what does it mean to comprehend.
Okay.
So the way this war exists is people do want to bring empirical evidence to it, but each camp pursues a different kind of evidence of success. So one camp is going to say, we'll give them a decontextualized vocabulary test. Sure enough, their method works better for that. The other camp is going to give them some passage, and they're going to look at their use of strategies, and they say, see, ours is better at that. Is that sort of how it goes? Or is there, when you try and find out whether your approaches to teaching reading work, is there the test that everybody agrees is the right test?
So I definitely think there's an assessment piece of this. In fact, there's been studies that show that if you assess reading comprehension using different methods, like either a short passage where they have to fill in the blank or a multiple choice or an open-ended, that there are different things that predict reading comprehension depending on the assessment. Mm. And so to some extent, yes, that's absolutely true. It depends on how we're measuring the outcome itself. And I think, no, there isn't a right answer because these constructs are very complex. So vocabulary, for example, you could assess receptively, expressively. You could use pictures. You could do decontextualized. There's lots of different ways, and they all might tap different kinds of knowledge. So it's important to have many different assessments, but they might lead to different outcomes.
So
that explains why the wars are still going.
So it could be. That's my hypothesis.
It's a good hypothesis.
And I've seen this a lot in cognitive domains. You know, if you're really a fan of procedural instruction, you give a test that's measuring how fast people can execute procedures. And if you're a fan of sort of deep understanding, you give a test that sort of says, you know, what happens next? Why is this like this? And they each claim they're winners, you know.
Yeah.
And their control condition is always a bastardization of the other theory anyway.
Right.
So. Yeah, and I think in addition to that, the way that we study it. So are we looking at skilled readers? Or are we looking at novice readers? Mm-hmm. Are we looking at readers who have a disability or who are struggling? All of those things matter in terms of how what we're learning about the reading process. And it's hard to bring it all together, but that's where the research needs to go.
Interesting.
So now we have a lot of reading games or shows, things on social media, things on computer screens. I remember when one of my kids was having trouble reading, they wanted me to do this, I don't even remember the name of it, but when you read and you push a button, you get like rewarded with a like, ta-da kind of thing. And I was like, so now we're bribing them into learning words. Like, it felt weird to me, but it worked. I mean, this kid definitely enjoyed it and got to be more fluent.
SAT prep. That's just like a touche. So let me ask a more pointed question.
Okay.
Because I get this question a lot if I travel around other countries. So they'll watch English. They'll watch movies with subtitles, and they think that's the way to learn the language. So they'll watch an English movie that might have, say, Mandarin subtitles, and they think that's the way they can learn English. What do you think?
So I think they're kind of two different questions. I think the question in terms of sort of getting lots of exposure to the English language through media, and then that sort of priming you to be able to pick it up, I think there is... some benefit to that, and then instruction is going to be needed when you're trying to get in a more advanced level of English. Mm-hmm. So, but that question's a little bit different from the question of using technology to support literacy skills that are in development. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that in schools we can do to help kids do additional practice, have more opportunities to try out their literacy strategies, but it shouldn't be the ultimate means of providing the instruction. So there's been research studies that show that if there's interaction with a teacher or a caregiver around the media, that it's much more beneficial than if the kid's just using the media by themselves. And so we know that providing that instruction, that support is important, and then using the media as backup or practice or additional exposure is useful.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are speaking with Rebecca Silverman about the reading wars and the best way to teach reading.
So I'm feeling really feisty today.
I could tell.
Well, so I appreciate the conclusion that the technology needs to be mediated by people. But that's just because the technology is crappy. And if I got it right, I wouldn't need people. I said I'm feisty.
Just explain what that means, because
Right now, you know, the way they do reading is really just vocabulary. Three words show up, and then there's an apple, and I have to choose which one's apple, and then I get explosions.
Right.
That's really lame. I mean, it's fun, but we can do much better. I can actually have on the computer technology a synthesized character that seems like another person who's engaging me in conversation.
Ah.
Right? And so the comparison, saying we need a human in the loop, it's not obvious to me that's true. Of course, you do need a human in the loop at some point, you know, but... it's a conclusion about the use of technology based on the technology that exists at this moment.
Okay, I totally get that.
Okay.
But there's also this notion, and we talk about this at Challenge Success, actually, that we want, reading is an important time, a family time, that there's a closeness and a connection that you get between a parent and a kid when you read bedtime stories, that there's, you're actually...
Wait, but that's like saying we should have dinner together. And I'm not trying
to help people
learn to have dinner. I'm using dinner to make social connections. If I'm trying to help people to read.
Totally fair point. Totally fair point. But I don't, but that could be, this is my hypothesis.
Okay, good.
That could be part of why the human connection seems to be important in the teaching of reading.
So I think you've led to the major controversy in the area of literacy.
Yeah, yes.
Is what is reading?
Oh.
Is it being able to read words on the page? Is it being able to comprehend what we're reading? Is it being able to use it socially for important functions in life? I mean, I think that's the hugest debate of all, and we lead to lots of different instructional practices depending on how we're defining literacy itself.
I love that.
No, that is, that's deep.
It's mind-blowing.
No, it's good. So
what
how,
is reading?
So how do you define literacy? You stepped in it. How do you define literacy?
What does the research say if it's not you, Rebecca?
So, no, I think researchers would suggest that there's literacy at many different levels, and so there's many forms of literacy. I tend to focus on literacy at the more reading, understanding, breaking the code, that kind of level, but there are many levels beyond that about how kids use literacy in their daily lives. And so I think all different perspectives on literacy are important.
So there you go. The answer once again is, yeah, you need all of it. You need all forms of literacy.
I mean, the one thing that I worry about with that answer is, so, like, I'm a preschool teacher, and I've got to set up my classroom. Do I label everything around the room, window, door, cabinet, whatever? Because that's kind of a lot of work if it's not going to have bang for the buck.
It's fun.
Rebecca, should I label? Tell us what to do.
Is it going to do damage?
Yeah, no, research definitely suggests that providing kids opportunity to see print in their environment can kind of prime them to be ready to access print. So we want to do that, but we also want to give them the rich experiences of just cuddling up with a parent or a teacher to read, because those are going to be important too.
I'm going to go out on a limb and I'm going to say, as I've said before on this show, I think you need to learn how to read.
Because there's something special about working with written text.
Because,
as opposed to spoken. So all these students want to watch, they want to hear a lecture in a college classroom rather than read a chapter.
Yeah, but when you're illiterate, when you can't read in American society, you are really left out.
Now.
Yeah, okay, but maybe that will change.
The question is there something special about text?
We think there is. We think the research is still coming out in this area, but we think that there is a way that learning to read changes the brain in a way that's important to humans, and we're still learning about that.
Love it. Thank you so much, Rebecca, for being here, and thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app, iTunes, and on SoundCloud.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.